Are there any supplements you can take to reverse aging? Now, there are a lot of controversial opinions about this topic, and there are a lot of supplements that you could take, but there aren't many supplements that have actual data showing that they have reversed some aspects of the hallmarks of aging or actually reversing the epigenetic age as measured by epigenetic age tests. But there are a few supplements out there that indeed have some evidence backing that up. So in this Q&A episode, we're going to cover this question and many others. If you want to ask me a question, then make sure you follow me on Instagram at Seemlund. So the first question is, are there any supplements that can actually reverse aging? So far, there's not no evidence that actual age reversal is possible, so that you can't really go from a older adult into a younger adult. Like, yes, you can improve your biomarkers, you can lose weight, you can become fitter, you can increase your VO2 max, you can go from a VO2 max of a 60-year-old to a VO2 max of a 20 or 30-year-old, whatever, but there's no actual evidence that you can literally, like, reverse the aging process and become, like, phenotypically, like, a younger individual. Of course, there's a lot of different opinions about that, and some people think it is possible, some people think that it is already proven, and there are some like cell studies, even like by David Sinclair, that he's done the cellular reprogramming recently, where they have like reversed quote-unquote the biological age of these cells using like the Yamanaka factors, which are these transcription factors that can affect like epigenetics and longevity. So I don't agree that there are literal supplements that can make you younger in terms of turning back the clock literally, but I do think that there are supplements shown to like improve many hallmarks of aging, like reverse the signs, visible signs of aging, reverse the decline in function that happens with aging, such as your cognition and other vital markers, etc. And this is what I'll be covering right now. So my premise is that you can't like directly reverse aging, but you can reverse or like reduce the age-related decline that happens with age. The first study is from 2019, and they looked at a collection of supplements for trying to regenerate the thymus. The thymus is an organ located in the chest that's important for the immune system. The supplements they used were low dose of human growth hormone, metformin, DHEA, which is a testosterone precursor, and vitamin D3. The participants saw a reduction in their inflammation levels, as well as improvement in kidney function. After 1 year of using the protocol, they saw a 1.5-year reduction in their epigenetic age, and by the end of the study, it was minus 2.5 years compared to the control group. First of all, a very interesting study, and I think that targeting one specific organ is a very smart way of going about it, because, or at least, you know, it's actually, you can see that, okay, this will affect one specific organ. You can't really take like broader conclusions from just this one organ, because aging is a multi-organ phenomenon. Like, you have to actually look at the entire body. The epigenetic age tests or the clocks themselves obviously are also controversial. Many people think that they're nonsense. Other people think that they are at least giving some insight into aging. I personally think that they can be very useful for sure. And what matters more is like the actual outcome of, you know, does the person's immune system actually improve? Does the other vital markers related to the immune system, etc., improve? Which in this case was true. About the supplements, then obviously some of the easier ones like metformin, DHEA, and vitamin D3 we have talked about quite often on this channel. Metformin is obviously something that younger individuals probably wouldn't benefit from, or if they don't have diabetes. If you're someone who has diabetes, then metformin is very beneficial. If you're younger, then taking metformin probably has like net negative effects, because it reduces your VO2 max, it might reduce your testosterone, it might reduce your you know, muscle growth capacity, etc. So for younger non-diabetic individuals, it's a net negative. Someone who has diabetes obviously will have a lot of benefits. DHEA is another like interesting one. Testosterone precursor, you know, it certainly will improve quality of life. It can increase your testosterone levels. If your testosterone levels are low, again, for younger individuals, it probably has little to no effect, but for someone who has low testosterone or who is older and they're experiencing age-related decline in testosterone, then for them, DHEA might bring them back up to more youthful levels with their testosterone. Now, growth hormone is another one of those things that is a bit more controversial. Like, I personally wouldn't take growth hormone even if I'm old, at least not based on the current evidence, because, you know, mechanistically speaking, growth hormone is involved in aging. Like, it actually promotes aging. It's one of the most like conserved pathways of aging in some sense, or longevity pathways. Again, it might improve the thymus regeneration, which obviously is very important. And with age, you see a decline in immune system function, you see an increase in immunosenescence, and a lot of it is mediated through the decline in your thymus function. So the thymus is something that ages quite rapidly compared to other organs. So if you can regenerate it and bring it back to a more youthful level, then in some ways, or you know, theoretically speaking, you will also increase your health span by staying healthier, by having a stronger immune system. But again, like, it kind of depends on the dose, depends on the individual, depends how long they're doing it. But I personally wouldn't like touch growth hormone without the reason, if that makes sense. The second supplement on the list is creatine. Everyone knows the benefits of creatine for sports performance, but it also has a lot of brain health and cognitive benefits. Now, while there are no direct studies that I'm aware of showing how creatine can reverse biological age measured by the epigenetic age test, I do think that creatine has plenty of evidence suggesting that it maintains more youthful aspects of physical performance and mental performance as well. And there's many other things that as well that have been seen to improve with creatine supplementation, like glucose tolerance and sleep. Like, you're able to like get away with less sleep, which is important from the perspective of longevity and aging. So I think there's just so much research about creatine that it works, and it works pretty much in many aspects, like your muscle strength, muscle mass, bone density, cognition, brain health, and even like in some of the neurodegeneration models, they see the creatine supplementation helps to like counteract some of that pathology, as well as in elderly people, supplementing creatine has been seen to improve memory. So yes, like from a functional side, not necessarily from like the biological age test side, but from a functional side, there's a lot of evidence showing that creatine does quote-unquote reverse aging by bringing you more to a youthful state in terms of your physical function, fitness, and your mental function or like cognition. I want to briefly mention about the David Sinclair's work that he's recently published regarding the epigenetic reprogramming of actually reversing cells into more youthful state in terms of their biological clock or epigenetic clock. Now, that's a very controversial study. They didn't do anything like groundbreaking, or they didn't do actual anything new. They just used the Yamanaka factors that have been previously already shown to reverse or revert the biological age of cells already before. There's no human studies yet proving that, and David Sinclair has said that you can use certain supplements to get the same effects, or not necessarily said, but he's like, you know, alluded to the fact. And he has a new supplement company as well, Tally Health, that sells Vitality, which is their supplement, and the ingredients are calcium alpha ketoglutarate, quercetin, transresveratrol, fisetin, and spermidine. Now, the Vitality blend doesn't have any like randomized clinical trials proving that it like reverses biological age or anything like that. Some of those specific ingredients do. So, for example, calcium alpha ketoglutarate, in a 2021 study, they did find that Rejuvent, which was calcium alpha ketoglutarate plus vitamin D, they found an 8-year reduction in biological age after 7 months using the true age DNA methylation test. Now, this is just one study, and obviously the company who has the Rejuvent patent, you know, they published the study, or they made the study, so it's obviously you have to take with a grain of salt. There's no other studies yet that have repeated that finding. So I think calcium alpha ketoglutarate is interesting. It is certainly one of the few supplements that has actual data suggesting that it reverses biological age by the DNA methylation tests. Whatever that means, that depends, you know, depends on who you're talking to. But at least we have some studies that they have reversed that number. Now, how relevant that number is, again, is very, you know, controversial and up to debate, but it's at least one of the few supplements that has that kind of data. Alpha ketoglutarate is like a metabolic mediator. It's important for the Krebs cycle, the energy production, and alpha ketoglutarate levels do decline with age. Now, the other ingredients like quercetin, transresveratrol, fisetin, and spermidine, those don't have any evidence of age reversal. There's obviously a lot of controversy about resveratrol. I think by now you can say that resveratrol doesn't extend lifespan even in animal studies. There was the recent NIH study on fisetin as well that failed to show life extension effects. Quercetin is a senolytic, as is fisetin, and they can help with senescent cells, but with senescent cells, not all senescent cells are bad. You don't want to eliminate them all because senescent cells are also involved in wound healing. So you need some senescent cells. You don't want to wipe them out completely. And lastly, spermidine is a supplement that I think has failed as well. A 2023 randomized placebo-controlled trial found that high-dose spermidine supplementation didn't even increase the spermidine levels in blood plasma and the saliva. Another 2022 randomized clinical trial on the elderly found that long-term spermidine supplementation in participants with subjective cognitive decline didn't modify memory and biomarkers compared to placebo. Now, dietary spermidine, I think, has quite a lot of benefits. There are a few studies finding that dietary spermidine intake is associated with reduced mortality, reduced heart disease, lower blood pressure, and that kind of thing. But there's no evidence that the supplemental spermidine would even like be beneficial in any way, at least not right now. So I think that you should definitely get your spermidine from dietary sources, from whole food ingredients. Things like chlorella, mushrooms, wheat germ, wheat bran, cheese, even like beef has smaller amounts. But the highest sources are wheat germ, chlorella, and wheat bran. And lastly, the supplements that I think all of you already know about, which is glycine and NAC, GlyNAC. There's multiple randomized control trials showing that the GlyNAC combo reverses hallmarks of aging like muscle strength, gait speed, cognition, insulin sensitivity, body composition, all those things improve in the elderly people. Now, I'm not going to go into detail in this video because you've already seen multiple videos me talking about it. If you haven't, then check out the longevity playlist in the description and you'll find the videos there. This episode is brought to you by Alitura Naturals. Alitura brings you the best natural skincare products for radiating skin and anti-aging. Regular skincare products are full of ingredients and fillers that actually cause more harm than good. Alitura uses only active ingredients sourced and handcrafted in Hawaii. Their products contain zero fillers. The Alitura Night Cream received the 2021 Clean Cert Beauty Awards for Best Face Cream. Alitura also has skin moisturizers, clay mask, serums, and cleansers. Head over to alitura.com and use the code SIIM, S-I-I-M, for a 20% discount. Alright, let's continue on with the rest of the Q&A. Next question, do you still have your 30 grams of protein shake on your non-training days? So yes, my daily diet has still stayed relatively the same. I'll have a protein shake with around 30, even like up to 40 grams of protein before my workout, and I'll work out and then I'll have dinner, the rest of my calories. So it's like a modified one meal a day. Now there's the recent study that we talked about on the channel as well, where they found that 100 grams of protein post-workout yielded superior results than 25 grams of protein. I think that's kind of supports my experience, at least. That's what I've seen. Like, I've never had issues with putting on muscle. I've never actually wanted to put on muscle that much either. I've never like solely focused on muscle hypertrophy. I've mostly focused on like muscle strength and just fitness in general. But I've never had like a plateau in terms of being able to put on size as long as I'm in a calorie surplus. And having smaller protein ingestion before training is beneficial for reducing muscle catabolism, and then ingesting larger amounts of protein after the workout, I believe, yes, at least in the based on the study, it yielded a superior anabolic response that lasted for a lot longer time, up to 12 hours. Now, the criticism for that study was that they used this milk protein, which is casein and slower to digest. Now, I talked with the author of the study on email, and he said the reason they used milk protein is that, yes, the specific reason they used milk protein was that it's slower to digest, and if you're in a real world, then all the foods that you eat are slower to digest. None of the foods, whatever you're eating, like meat, potatoes, beans, eggs, whatever, they're all slower to digest than whey protein, because whey protein is super fast to digest. So you can't really compare the findings from those studies where they use whey protein shakes to actual real world where you're eating whole foods that are slower to digest. So that's why they use the milk protein, and milk protein kind of mimicked the aspect of a real meal, so to say, that it takes a longer time to digest. So at least based on my experience, that's what I'm going to keep doing. And I think that having larger amounts of protein in the post-workout window makes sense, at least for a younger individual. maybe not for like an older individual, for them it makes sense to spread it out a little bit to maintain better anabolism, but at least you don't have to be worried about, oh, I need to have 3 to 4 protein ingestions per day. There's, I think for the younger individual, there's no reason to do that. Next question, are benefits of glycine and other anti-aging supplements related to their ability to decrease methylation? So not necessarily. So methylation is the process of moving methyl groups around. DNA methylation is the methyl groups attaching to DNA and regulating epigenetics. There are some longevity supplements that have beneficial effects on methylation by increasing methylation. You know, like TMG is a very good methyl donor. Glycine is also a methyl donor. And even creatine has those properties, B12. So I think with methylation, it comes down to like, you know, it's another bell curve situation. Hypomethylation, which is undermethylation, is bad. And hypermethylation, overmethylation, is also bad. So it mostly is the best sweet spot is somewhere in the middle. So you don't want to be necessarily taking large amounts of methyl donors. But if you are hypomethylating, or if you're not getting enough methyl donors from a diet, then they are beneficial. So it's never more is better, or it's never that this is good or bad. It's, you know, the body mostly functions best in homeostasis or in balance. Next question, does it impact glucose in which order you eat your food? Hashtag glucose queen. So I think you're referring to the glucose goddess and her information about going through specific order of foods. So generally, yes, if you drink a glass of soda, which is pure sugar, and no fiber and no protein and no fats, then your glucose is going to, yeah, rise much higher than if you were to eat vegetables and protein first. So from that perspective, it makes sense to, yeah, eat the lower glycemic and protein rich foods first before you introduce the carbohydrates. I agree with that. You know, how relevant it is depends on the person and the situation. So for example, if I'm coming from a hard workout, I've been completely fasted, my glycogen is very low, then for me in that situation, it might be actually better to drink liquid sugar or to consume carbohydrates like potatoes or rice or whatever it is, because it's going to replenish my glycogen. It's not going to have pretty much any significant effect on my blood sugar response, because my body will just shuttle that glucose into the muscle glycogen. Whereas someone who has diabetes and they are, let's say, with worse glucose tolerance, then for them it's more important to have like a fiber and protein first before eating carbohydrates. So it depends a lot on the individual. And normal, it's very normal for your blood sugar to go up and down. The problem is when it goes up and stays elevated. That's like insulin resistance. Your body isn't able to produce insulin to lower the blood sugar levels. So depends a lot on the situation. Generally, a normal person doesn't have to worry about the big fluctuations in your blood sugar unless you are, yeah, like just having a massive amount of cake or something like that. So in that case, it might be more beneficial to use things that lower the blood sugar response, like apple cider vinegar has been shown to do it up to like 30 to 50%. You can use berberine, you can use some other glucose disposal agents. So yeah, there's things that you can do to control the blood sugar response, but having a small increase and then a come down in your blood sugar is normal, and there's no, like, nothing to really worry about it. The problem is, yeah, when it goes up and stays elevated. Next question, what are the healthiest and least toxic seafood options? So seafood generally is, yeah, very nutritious. It has a lot of vitamins and minerals, and also high in omega-3 fatty acids, which are important for the brain and heart health. But yeah, the unfortunate issue is that a lot of seafood is polluted due to the environmental pollution, and even a lot of the seafood contains microplastics and stuff like that. So it's not, yeah, the most cleanest, pristine food. And pretty much all the seafood is affected to a certain extent, because the ocean is, or it's, you know, all connected. The ocean is an open body of water, and all the like pollutants go into there. And so over time, the fish and other life forms, they accumulate whatever, like heavy metals or microplastics into them. So one easy way to avoid that is to not eat the larger type of fish that accumulate more of the heavy metals over the course of their lifetime. So like tuna, swordfish, and these other bigger fish, those are generally higher in heavy metals. Smaller fish like sardines, herring, sprats, those things, they die before, or you know, they're much smaller as well, so they accumulate less of these heavy metals. So that's an easy fix. Salmon is something, you know, interesting in some sense. The farmed salmon is in some sense cleaner. It has less heavy metals because it's not in open water, so to say. But at the same time, the farmed salmon is still fed a pretty crappy diet, and the omega-3 profile of farmed salmon isn't very healthy either. So, and even then, you can make the argument that yes, the fish and seafood contains heavy metals, but they also contains these different minerals that support glutathione production, like selenium and other, you know, these nutrients that help you to actually detox from the heavy metals and etc. So, you know, if you're eating only tuna, then that's probably not a smart idea. You're going to get a lot of heavy metals. Like, I think Tony Robbins, in the past, I heard that he ate a lot of tuna and he saw his blood test and his mercury levels were like sky high. So, you know, you can easily avoid this mistake by not eating only tuna or only swordfish or only fish for that matter. So if you diversify your protein sources, then you can easily avoid that. And if you eat, let's say, fish a few times per week, then that's already enough to get some of these omega-3s and other vitamins and minerals. I much rather take like an omega-3 supplement as well as an insurance policy to get, because you're not going to get the required amount of omega-3 fats from just the fish anyway. Like, the optimal amount is up to like 2.5 grams of EPA DHA per day, whereas if you eat even fish every day, you might get like 1.5 grams per day from just the fish, and you would need to eat a lot of fish. So at that point, it becomes a bit more, let's say, harder to counteract like the heavy metal side. Next question, thoughts on taking vitamin C on cardio days and muscle adaptation. Large amounts of antioxidants after resistance training has been shown pretty repeatedly to blunt the hypertrophy response, at least. So you're going to build less muscle if you take antioxidants after lifting weights. Now, the same doesn't apply to cardio, because cardio is a different adaptation. And there's actually a lot of evidence that antioxidants improve, you know, cardiorespiratory, let's say, fitness and recovery as well. So if you're doing cardio, then ice baths and taking antioxidants is actually a good thing, because it speeds up recovery and even helps with some of the adaptations. Maybe not like very large amounts of antioxidants just for the sake of hormesis, because you do still want to not only improve like the exercise performance, but you also want to get the other beneficial adaptations from exercise, like the immune system adaptations, resilience, and those kind of things. So you don't want to like blunt the hormetic signal. So you don't want to eliminate the reactive oxygen species, even if you're doing cardio. So depends on like, do you need fast recovery, and what's your other diet like? So if you're eating different kinds of vegetables and fruits and berries, then chances are you don't need additional vitamin C supplement. If you're someone who does multiple workouts per day, or like every day, pretty much strenuous workouts, and you need to recover fast, then yes, take an ice bath to recover faster from the cardio, and then in the evening you have the lifting session, etc., then you're recovered faster. And the same with antioxidants, with vitamin C. You can take the vitamin C after the first workout of the day, and then the second workout, you're more recovered. Or if you want to prepare for tomorrow's workout faster, and you don't care about muscle growth or muscle hypertrophy at that point, then yes, you can take the vitamin C, but on a regular basis, it's not the best to blunt the stress response or the inflammation from the exercise. Next question, if you work out 6 days a week, but volume matches a 3 day full body, is it the same for longevity? I think it's good to move every day, at least walk every day, at least get, you know, the research shows that up to 12,000 steps a day is associated with the lowest mortality risk. So walking 12,000 steps a day every day is a very good thing to do, regardless if you exercise or not. Now, when you're talking about actual exercise, then there does appear to be some J-shaped curve, at least with resistance training, which I've talked about in some videos as well, that no resistance training is bad associated with increased risk. Doing like a moderate amount is the lowest risk, but doing too much is associated with higher risk. So I think if you do like resistance training and you lift weights 2 to 3 times per week, then that's already going to give you the maximum benefits for longevity and mortality risk reduction. You're not going to probably see additional benefits beyond that, and it might be actually increasing the risk or providing like these diminishing returns, at least based on the recent meta-analyses on that topic. When it comes to moderate exercise, so zone 2 cardio, hiking, speed walking, those kind of things, gardening, then the evidence shows that the more of those things you do, the lower your risk of mortality is. So the more you walk, the more you garden, the more you hike, the lower your risk of mortality generally is. So this moderate type of physical exercise, somewhere around zone 1, zone 2. But going above that, zone 3, zone 4, zone 5, that starts to provide diminishing returns. Now, if you work out 6 times a week and the duration is the same as 3 times per week, then probably you wouldn't see any difference. Maybe from a nervous system perspective, you might eventually start to feel a bit more fatigued if you don't have any days off, because, you know, remember that the adaptation occurs when you're resting. So if you're never resting, you're every day you're like triggering the stimulus, then your body is always repairing itself, but it's never adapting. It's always repairing itself enough to prepare for the next workout, but it never has enough time to adapt and become stronger and more resilient, if that makes sense. So it's always repairing, but it's never adapting if you're just having every day even short periods of intense workouts. So I think having a few rest days in between is a smart idea, but if you're doing like moderate intensity in those days, then you can get away with it. So what I like to do is, you know, day 1 heavy resistance training, day 2 either complete rest or something that is moderate or low intensity, like hiking or longer walking. Then again, day 3 is going to be some more intense resistance training, maybe zone 2 cardio even a bit longer, and day 4 is going to be another low intensity or rest day. So I'll like cycle between high intensity, low intensity, or rest. So that gives your body enough time to recover. Whereas if you're always every day high intensity, high intensity, high intensity, high intensity, then maybe rest, then your body, unless you are like super athletic, unless you're like a professional athlete and you've been doing this for years, then you might get away with it. But for the average person, then it is more beneficial to have a few days off. And what you might see is that you actually start to build more muscle as well as a result of that, because your body actually has the time to recover and adapt, if that makes sense. Next question, is lysine and proline supplementation equally important as glycine supplementation? Glycine, hydroxyproline, and proline are the 3 amino acids of collagen. Collagen is 30% glycine, so that's why glycine is, and glycine is also the rate limiting step in collagen synthesis. So glycine is more important than hydroxyproline and proline, and chances are you're getting hydroxyproline and proline from other foods as well in plenty amounts, whereas the demand for glycine is much higher because glycine is also used for other things like glutathione and creatine synthesis. So you need more glycine than hydroxyproline and proline. So there's no reason to take hydroxyproline and proline, and chances are you're getting enough of them from the diet, whereas with the glycine it's not really the case. You might, you know, benefit from some supplementation, or if you're eating a lot of glycine, then that's not necessary, which is unlikely unless you're eating like pork skins and those kind of things. With lysine is not part of the collagen, and I don't think that there's no reason to take lysine as well, and you're probably getting it from the dietary sources. Next question, should I worry if I don't move much after my post-dinner snack? So a snack, probably not. So if you're having a smaller meal that has 200, 300 calories, then probably not like a small pre-bed snack like cottage cheese and berries or something like that. That's fine. It's not going to, because the food volume itself is also going to be small and the calories are also relatively small. Now, if you're having like a bigger dinner, then it would be better to move a little bit by going for like a 10-minute walk even is going to be enough to improve the digestion and lower your blood sugar levels, and yeah, make sure that you're not going to be stuffed before bed. So I think, you know, you have your dinner, you walk 10 to 15 minutes, that's good. And if you have a snack later and you don't walk after that, then that's fine. Like, it's not going to be that big of a deal. Of course, you have to measure your own sleep or measure how you feel by doing that. You know, if you feel worse, if your sleep score is worse by doing that, then of course it is an issue. And you can, then you can try, okay, I'm going to go for a shorter, maybe five or six minute walk and see what happens. Next question, advice if I want to start tracking my zone 2 and VO2 max as a beginner. So the Polar heart rate monitor H10, you just strap it around your chest, connect it to your phone, and there you can just directly measure your heart rates and heart beats. So you can just see, okay, am I in zone 2, zone 1? Zone 2 is usually 60 to 70% of your maximum heart rate. So the app will already tell you as well which zone are you in, and that's like a very useful tool, because yeah, you know, you can assess through your nasal breathing whether or not you are in zone 2, but sometimes after a while you can kind of deceive yourself slightly. You're running faster than is zone 2, and but you're still breathing through the nose because you've kind of gotten used to it. So yeah, like tracking the heart rate with the Polar heart rate monitor is the kind of the best way to do that. And other than that, like, that's the pretty much the only tool you would need to do zone 2. Of course, you don't need the heart rate monitor. You can, yeah, just pay attention to your nasal breathing, but it's a very useful tool. I think it's one of the best fitness tools that you can use for sure. There's also the Holo Habits habit tracker that I'm partnered with, and they have different kinds of challenges that you can do, and my VO2 max challenge is part of the app. So there I'll walk you through the different workouts and teach you how to increase your VO2 max in more detail, so you can check it out. It's Holo Habits on the App Store, on both the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store, so you can check it out. The last question, how many grams of protein do you eat in a day? Right now, I'm probably eating around 130 to 150 grams of protein. So my body weight is 79 kilograms. So for my body weight, that would be around 0.8 grams of protein per pound of body weight, which actually is the upper limit they see is needed for muscle hypertrophy. So beyond that, you don't see any additional muscle growth benefits, and you could even eat less. So that's why I'm between 130 to 150. So I'll be getting, yeah, around 0.7 to 0.8 grams per pound of body weight of protein per day, which is perfectly, it's like pretty much up there in terms of maximizing the benefits of protein on muscle growth. So you don't need to eat more than that. You could eat less than that, but it's not going to maximize the muscle growth benefits. And yeah, that's perfectly fine for me. All right, that's it for this Q&A. If you want to ask me a question, then make sure you follow me on Instagram at Seemlund. Other than that, thanks for watching this video. Make sure you click a like and subscribe. My name is Seem. Stay optimized, stay empowered.